Good evening and welcome to Tisky Sour. It's Friday night, which means very little in this day and age, except for me, that I get to spend the evening with Dahlia Gabriel. Dahlia, how are you doing?
Hi, Michael. I'm doing all right. My boiler's packed in, so I'm rediscovering the joys of a bucket bath, but we move.
We have some massive stories for you tonight, and we have two huge stories where we have one of the main protagonists involved on the show, later in the show. And we're going to be talking about the really quite bizarre going-ons in the Labour Party at the moment. We're going to be talking to Howard Beckett, who's Assistant General Secretary of Unite and one of the leading voices on the left on the National Executive Committee of the party. So we'll be talking about the controversies that are going on and how the left can respond. What power do the left still have in the Labour Party under Keir Starmer? Myself and Dahlia, we're going to be talking about two other big stories tonight. One of them, coronavirus and the debate going on among scientists and politicians about the speed that we're going to unravel the current lockdown. And also a very irresponsible interview that Julia Hartley Brewer did and her pride in not doing research before going live on air. Never would I do such a thing. The Guardian is supposed to be Britain's most liberal newspaper. And in the recent past, it has broken some stories which are genuinely uncomfortable for those in power. For example, working with Julian Assange and Edward Snowden to reveal state secrets about Britain and the USA. However, its descent into a lapdog of the establishment, one way to put it, has been clear over the past 5 years, in which its attacks on Jeremy Corbyn became ever more hysterical. The paper has now also sacked a columnist for a tweet critical of Israel. Now, the journalist in question is Nathan Robinson. Nathan is the editor of the left-wing magazine Current Affairs and has been writing a column for The Guardian US, so the US version of The Guardian, since 2018. This is his page on the website. So you can see there, Nathan Robinson. Nathan Robinson is the editor of Current Affairs and a Guardian US columnist. Lots of articles about American politics. However, in late December, when Congress was authorizing a new package of COVID relief money for Americans, at the same time, it also signed off on $500 million more in military aid to Israel. So at the same time as passing this COVID relief bill, it also guaranteed $500 million to Israel. And that prompted this quip from Robinson. So Nathan tweets, "Did you know that the US Congress is not actually permitted to authorize any new spending unless a portion of it is directed towards buying weapons for Israel? It's the law." I read that. I thought that's clearly a joke. He goes on to clarify, "or if not actually the written law, then so ingrained in political custom as to functionally be indistinguishable from the law." You can see the joke that's being made there. Now, after this tweet, John Mulholland, who is editor-in-chief of The Guardian US, sent Robinson an email with the heading "private and confidential." Now, luckily, because of an article Nathan has written in Current Affairs, this email is no longer private and confidential. Mulholland writes of the tweet, "No such law exists, in which case this is, as one might say, fake news. Given the reckless talk over the last year and beyond of how mythical Jewish groups' alliances yield power over all forms of US public life, I am not sure how this is helpful to public discourse, and I am not sure why singling out financial aid to Israel in a tweet and devoid of any context and without mention of aid to other countries, either currently or historically, is useful for public discourse." Now, the email concludes, and I think actually this is a quote which John Mulholland is including, I can ask Nathan in a moment, with saying that the only Jewish state controls the most powerful country in the world is clearly anti-Semitic. The myth of Jewish power informs murderous hatred. Delete this and apologize. Now, in response to that email, Nathan Robinson, you know, didn't say F you, I'll tweet whatever I want. No. Nathan messages, "John, I have no wish to contribute to the mountain of fake news on the internet and realize it is my responsibility as someone who writes for you not to say things that could confuse people. I have deleted the tweet and clarified. I am sorry to cause you trouble. Occasionally dash off a tweet without consideration of potential to create misunderstanding. Thank you for letting me know." And Joel Mulholland replies, you know, an hour later saying, "Nathan, thank you for that swift reply and action. I greatly appreciate your thoughtful response." Now, most people would have thought that's probably the end of the story, case closed. However, after this incident, Nathan's pitches went unanswered. And then this Tuesday, he was fired. Nathan is no longer a Guardian columnist, but he is still the editor of Current Affairs, and he joins me now. Thank you so much for coming on the show at this pivotal moment in your career, Nathan.
Yeah, hello, Michael. Nice to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start with, you know, a basic question, I suppose, which is, you know, how confident are you that the reason they've let you go is because of this tweet?
And it's not just a
coincidence.
No, they told me. So I work with an editor who is not John Mulholland. I've only interacted with John Mulholland once, but my editor called me this week because my editor had not been replying to my new columns. I'm submitting ideas for columns. I'm sending, you know, usually my editor calls me and goes, I'd like you to write about this, but, you know, radio silence. I finally get in touch with my editor and they say explicitly, I would have been commissioning you for the past month, but this thing with John makes it kind of awkward. I need to work it out with John. I need to sit down and have a meeting with him. And I said, well, could you do that, please? Because I rather depend on this income. So it would be nice if we could get this all straightened out. And then my editor called me the next day to say that they had a meeting with Mr. Mulholland and that he had decided to discontinue the column. And that it was very clearly because he was still upset over the tweet. So, I mean, there's no doubt. And in fact, The Guardian was asked about it. They've put out a public statement, and the public statement does not deny that they let me go over just this tweet. They didn't allege anything else that I had done. And their only defense of what they did is to say that I wasn't really fired because their columnists don't have any guarantee. They don't have job security, essentially. There's no contracts for the columnists, right? They can fire you whenever they want.
Yeah, I saw that statement because, you know, on reading that first statement, it almost reads as if, oh, this guy Nathan, he's delusional. He never really worked for us in the first place, just a couple of freelance articles. But then you look up your name on the website and it says you are a columnist at the newspaper. So it's very clear.
This is crazy because you notice in his email, he says, as you present yourself as a Guardian columnist. And I thought to myself, I was reading that. I was going, but I am a Guardian columnist. I was originally a contributor. I contributed for a while, and then my editor gave me a promotion to full columnist, right? Which comes with they more than double your pay per article, and they put you on as a columnist, and it means that you get to write regularly for them, like any newspaper columnist. So it was this very bizarre kind of like, you're not really a columnist at all, so we're not really firing you. What is this?
Very bizarre. I want to bring up the substance of the tweet. So in that, yeah. I do recommend our audience go and read your article in Current Affairs because it has this great graphic, because the editor-in-chief has accused you of singling out Israel. He's saying this is the only Jewish state. Why are you singling out Israel? In your explanation of all of these events, you sort of evidence, again, it was a jokey tweet, but you evidence the basis for it with this graphic: countries scaled to the foreign military aid they receive from the US. So you can see there, Israel far and away more than any other country with 3.1 billion pounds. So you look at that graph, you don't say, why would you possibly single out Israel looking at that graph? Well, because it's the biggest, it gets the most money, and it has for quite a while. He also said, why didn't you put in context that there have been other states in the past which have got lots of military aid? So I don't know if under the joke you were supposed to say, oh, by the way, also the Marshall Plan meant the US sent a lot of money abroad in the 40s. Do you think there's anything that he said that was remotely reasonable there? Well, is there a point where you're like, oh, maybe wasn't?
So Israel is the largest cumulative recipient of military aid. It's been surpassed on a year-by-year basis since that graphic by Afghanistan, I think, with security aid. But it's received more in military dollars than any other country, right? And I am not the one who originally singled out Israel for a special relationship with the United States. United States policy has singled out Israel. And in fact, if you look at the statements of United States politicians, I mean, it is official U.S. policy that we are supposed to help Israel maintain what is called its, quote, qualitative military edge over all other powers in the region. Israel is like Saudi Arabia. It's a close U.S. ally, and we prioritize them. So, you know, we discussed Saudi Arabia in Current Affairs too, right? Which is that states that the United States has, to serve its own interests, decided to give disproportionate support to, it just funnels money to, even as it's stiffing U.S. voters with $600 COVID relief checks, the money keeps flowing to our military allies. I mean, again, that doesn't seem like I'm singling out Israel. U.S. politicians for decades and decades have said it's our job to make sure Israel is the strongest power in the Middle East.
And I suppose in terms of the wider significance this has on, I suppose freedom of speech is one way to put it, but also, you know, just journalistic integrity and freedom. I saw you spoke to Bad Faith podcast yesterday, and they put out a really interesting clip, which was you saying, in a way, you're glad they've let you go, that they fired you, because if you were to remain at The Guardian, because you were, you know, to some degree financially reliant on them, you've also got your own magazine, but to some degree, you know, you wanted to keep that job, you would have held your tongue when it came to issues about Israel, Palestine. And now you feel like actually you've got the freedom to continue speaking your mind. So are you working on the assumption that everyone that works for The Guardian now is a bit terrified to tweet about Israel?
Well, Michael, look at what an obsequious toady I was in that email to John Mulholland that I sent to him when he had, you know, swooped down, having never really interacted with me before, and said, you know, you better get rid of this. Instantly, I went, oh God, because I needed my job. It's gone now, so, you know, but I was like, oh, well, this is the editor-in-chief of The Guardian. You got to keep him happy. You better delete the tweet, right? And so I was going to self-censor. And I did, in fact. So he successfully got me to self-censor because I knew that I had no job security whatsoever. I knew that any moment John Mulholland decided to stop printing my columns, there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. And so if that's the situation with me, and I have my own magazine, I'm not a freelancer, so I am able actually to go somewhere else. I'm not completely dependent on this. It's about a quarter of what I make in a year. So it's a lot of money to lose. But no, journalists, if you're a freelancer, you know, I could say what I want at Current Affairs, but if I wanted to get another newspaper column, The Guardian, as you said earlier, is the most progressive of the major newspapers. So if you're toxic for anti-Semitism at The Guardian, you're out, you're gone. So you can see how the employment relationship creates so much coercive pressure on people to be quiet on any issue that's going to irritate the employer.
Do you have a sense of where it came from in The Guardian? Does it seem like it was just this one person's individual decision, or have you got an idea of that there was a bit of a fight within the organization and some people were sticking up for you and some people were saying, no, you've got to go, and one side won out? What's your, you know, what's the criminology of all of this? If we're looking at the top of the institution.
I know very little. Here is what I know, is that my editor, who I had a good relationship with, tried to convince John Mulholland not to let me go, and did not succeed. Also, the only other piece of information that I have, we have that quote in the email, which is this weird thing at the, after his signature on the email where it's the delete this and apologize thing, where it looks like it's coming from someone else that he's posted, whether it's something he found on Twitter or whether it's someone else at The Guardian. I mean, he's the US editor, but it's a British newspaper. So I believe he reports ultimately to someone in the British Guardian. I don't quite know. But one thing I did learn from my editor was that at least someone in the London office of The Guardian had been there had been calls from the British office to the US office about this rogue US columnist. And that really made sense to me because obviously the anti-Semitism flap has been so bad in Britain that I wouldn't be surprised if, even though US is notorious for stifling criticism of Israel, if someone in Britain had said, you know, you've got an anti-Semitic columnist, you need to let him go. And John Mulholland might not have even been really, maybe he believes what he said to me, maybe he didn't, and he was just told, like, your columnist is anti-Semitic, he needs to go. I don't know. All I know is someone in the British office was mad, and my editor did try and save my job.
I mean, I do get the sense, I think there is something that's particularly pernicious in Britain right now. And you often do see it when we look across the pond to sort of debates in the United States about the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism, which many people think silences criticism of Israel, which, I mean, we do. I argued against it. That's really difficult to discuss in this country. But once you get to the United States, it seems that actually you've got a bit more of a grown-up conversation going on. So it doesn't surprise me that this clampdown has come from The Guardian. Nathan, I want to bring up one tweet from you that your critics have been circling. There is no cancel culture. The fastest way to get a book deal in this country is to whine about cancel culture. Every single one of these people ends up on their feet. They are fine. They have giant platforms. They are heard loud and clear. Right-wing opinions are everywhere. You know, when you were talking about this, you were talking about right-wing people getting canceled. or not get, I mean, you were saying cancel culture doesn't exist, right-wing people losing their platforms. Now you've lost your platform for tweeting something that has offended someone high up in a literary establishment or a news organization. Have you changed your mind about cancel culture?
I wasn't the victim of cancel culture, right? Because cancel culture is supposed to be when a big mob comes for you, when the big social justice wokeness mob comes for you, and they try and publicly shame you, and then your employer, you know, who likes you, capitulates to the big mob. My situation was plain old manufacturing consent, right? It was the public didn't call for my firing. The Guardian didn't want anyone to know they were firing me. The email was private and confidential. He was trying to squeeze me out without anybody noticing. There was nothing about the culture. In fact, the culture, now that I have exposed it, has been very much on my side. So the reason that I object a lot to the kind of formulation of cancel culture is that it removes power from the picture entirely. And it almost suggests that power operates the opposite way than it really does. Like, power is democratic, right? It's the mob. It's the left. It's the masses. And I don't tend to think that that is how power works. It's not, when I'm saying cancel culture doesn't exist, I'm not saying censorship doesn't exist. I'm not saying repression doesn't exist. Of course those things exist. And the way that they usually occur is, as I say, not when right-wing opinions are victimized by anti-racists, right? It's the BDS activists. It's people who irritate corporations. It's people who irritate powerful governments. And so you can use the term cancel culture if you like to describe how censorship works. But I think what it does is it suggests that there's just this giant persecution of both right and left opinions, maybe left opinions, but mostly right wing opinions, mostly like, you know, you can't say the N word anymore or whatever. And I don't think that's how power works, right? I think power is perfectly satisfied to amplify right wing opinions. Barry Weiss, who complains about this all the time, she didn't get fired from the New York Times. I got fired from the Guardian for criticizing U.S. policy to Israel. She resigned in protest from the New York Times, but they were going to, they'd keep publishing her garbage for years. You know, David Brooks publishes every week whining about cancel culture. So, you know, where is it? As I say, you know, these people end up fine, and it's people who criticize powerful governments that end up not fine.
And finally, how do you think this is going to affect your career? I mean, in that tweet, it is interesting, you know, the way you say for many of these right wingers, when they get cancelled, that's actually a launch pad to bigger things. Yeah. At the same time, I mean, there is a lot of reputational risk involved in being let go because of a tweet which someone thought was anti-Semitic. I mean, how do you think this is going to change your career, or do you think it's not going to change it very much at all?
I'm very lucky because I have this magazine, Current Affairs, and we're an independent, we're like you, we're an independent left-wing outlet that can survive on our own. And the fact that I've helped build that over the course of the past few years gives me some level of security and comfort where I can now continue to, I'll just write for Current Affairs and I'll just, I'll have much more freedom and nobody will be looking over my tweets, which is great. But I only have that because over the past years, many leftists, we've been building these independent platforms that have that freedom. I think my career as a columnist for a mainstream newspaper is toast, right? Because, as I say, they all think I'm an anti-Semite now. So maybe that someone, I don't know, would just out of desire to be controversial would hire me. But I doubt it. I think probably I'll just be writing for Current Affairs. It would be so much worse for me if I was a freelancer, as I say. And I'm also, like, I'm a white guy with Ivy League degrees. We always end up fine. Like, you know, if I was Palestinian, right, you know, this would be the end of my career. You know, and in fact, look, you know, you look at what happened to someone like Steve Salata at the University of Illinois, who criticized Israel on Twitter, got his job offers revoked. Now he's driving a school bus, and he has been for the past few years. He likes driving a school bus. He's written about how satisfying his job driving a school bus is. It's not that he doesn't consider, and I don't think we should consider it, you know, coming down there. But the point is, his academic career, it completely ended by these tweets about Israel.
I'm going to obviously segue this into asking people to support Navarra Media because we need an independent media. But first of all, I think we should say go to Current Affairs, read that full article from Nathan Robinson. What's the website? How do they get to it?
Currentaffairs.org. Please subscribe. We do need you. We do depend on you. The Guardian has $1 billion endowment, which they don't tell people about, but we don't.
Wow. Wow.
I only found this out because my editor sort of confessed it to me once. I was like, how do you guys survive? And they said, well, we do have a $1 billion fund from a dead rich guy. And I was like, but it says like reader supported at the top. And it's like, well, partially readers.
10%, 10%. Well, I don't know the percent. I should be clear. I don't know what percent.
Well, they do have a financial report. You can actually go. It's all public information. So
we'll do an episode on that sometime. Nathan Robinson, thank you so much for joining us this evening. We really do appreciate it. Keep on tweeting.
Thanks, Michael. It was fun.
As I said, I was going to segue into why you should support independent media like Current Affairs, like Navarra Media. It means that we don't have to be that careful with what we tweet. I mean, obviously, I don't want to, you know, offend people on Twitter for no reason whatsoever, but I don't want to feel like I can't tweet this or that, or we can't cover this or that on the show because someone at the top, someone who has material power over us can say, I don't like this. That doesn't happen at Navarra Media, which is why we can tell it how it is. So if you want to continue helping to build an independent media, please do go to navarramedia.com/support and go check out currentaffairs.org. In coronavirus news, it was today announced the reproduction rate of coronavirus is between 0.7 and 0.9%. This is the lowest it has been since July. The figure means that according to government estimates, the epidemic should be shrinking between 2 and 5% every day. Now, ONS statistics released today estimate that in the week up to the 6th of February, 1 in 80 people in England had COVID, 1 in 75 in Northern Ireland, 1 in 85 in Wales, and 1 in 150 in Scotland. The place with the highest prevalence in the UK is London, with 1 in 60. So the good news is that cases are going down. The bad news is that they are still quite high. There is a week lag here. So that was the prevalence of the virus a week ago. It's presumably slightly lower now, given that the R rate is below 1. The biggest worry, though, at the moment is still hospitalizations. In this picture, you can see that we still have a lot more people in hospital now than there were at the very peak of the crisis. There are 25,621 people in hospital. There were just over 20,000 at that peak. So we're in a pretty perilous situation still. And the daily death toll is averaging 754. Now, all of this means it was a bit odd today when there was, well, not today, this whole week, when the big talking point has been, should you or should you not book your holiday? I mean, obviously, the answer is just wait and see. But on the 22nd of February, Boris Johnson is due to announce more immediate plans for exiting England's lockdown, at least, perhaps to try and influence what gets announced. Britain's most high-profile scientists have this week been getting their thoughts in early on what should happen next. Now, John Edmonds, we've shown you clips of him a bunch of times before on the show. He is one of Britain's leading epidemiologists and sits on SAGE. Now, he spoke to Robert Peston earlier this week and advised caution when asked about reopening schools from March the 8th. That's the date most recently set as a target by Boris Johnson.
If we opened up schools, I think that the reproduction number would get close to 1 and possibly exceed 1. If we opened them completely, if we opened secondary schools and primary schools both at the same time, I suspect we'd be lucky to keep the reproduction number below 1.
So your advice at this stage would be the Prime Minister phase the return and see how it goes?
I think we have to do everything very gradually and see how it goes, because we're just learning this with this new variant. We don't know that much about its transmissibility, so we're going to have to feel our way a little bit. So I think that we have to do things gradually, steadily evaluate, and then look to the next phase if we can.
Now, Peston also put to Edmonds the idea that after we vaccinate the vulnerable, we could just let the virus rip.
It would be very dangerous. Vaccines don't offer 100% protection. At the moment, of course, most people have just had the single dose. And so they're not fully protected. They haven't reached their maximum level of protection. So I think easing up now would be really dangerous.
But if we got to that stage of, as I say, the top 9 groups all having had, let's say, a first dose or maybe first and second dose, at that point, how dangerous, as I say, would it be at that point to allow essentially a return to normal that would undoubtedly see the virus spreading among younger people?
Well, I still think you would then start to get a lot of cases in vaccine failures. So if a vaccine is 90% protected, let's say, and that would be very good. And we vaccinate 90% of people, and that would be very good. Then of the high risk people, then that actually leaves, if you multiply 0.9 by 0.9, you get 0.81. So you've actually protected 81% of the population, leaving almost 20% who are not protected. And so you would have still, under those very optimistic scenario situation, you would still have roughly 20% of the highest risk group unprotected. And so if you let it rip, they would get infected very rapidly and soon be filling up your hospitals and, unfortunately, your morgues.
So John Edmonds there advising quite a lot of caution, and basically saying, yes, probably we can start to open schools in March, but we should do it very slowly. If they all go back at the same time, R will definitely go above one. That's what he's suggesting there. As to that final point, I thought that was very interesting, saying, you know, even if you've got 90% protection from COVID and you've vaccinated 90% of people, if you then say, well, the vulnerable are fine, so let's let the virus run wild through the rest of the population, you still will end up with quite a few people who aren't fully protected who could end up in hospital. Now, I mean, one question you might have there, and I still have it, I have to admit, is that some people are suggesting that maybe for hospitalizations, the vaccines are close to 100% effective. But I mean, clearly this is why we need to do things slowly, so we can work it out as we go along and not have another terrifying spike come in the future. So if we're going to loosen it slowly. Edmonds there was, I think, quite, let's say, pessimistic or very, very cautious. Professor Neil Ferguson, who is, I suppose, probably the most high profile epidemiological modeler in the country. He advises the government as part of the new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group. He used to be part of SAGE until he had to resign because of an encounter during the first lockdown with a lover. He spoke to Politico's Westminster Insider podcast and was slightly more positive than Edmonds. So he told the host, "We're in a better place than I might have anticipated a month ago. The lockdown has really driven down cases quite fast. They're basically halving about every 17 days at the moment or so. And that means in a month's time, the Prime Minister's talked about potentially reopening schools. We might have some bandwidth to do that, at least primary schools. And if we continue to see then a continued decline without large outbreaks, then perhaps starting to relax other aspects of society the following month." So he's saying we should be able to open some schools in March and start relaxing other things the following month. But he did also warn caution. He said we shouldn't loosen lockdowns too quickly and all at once, as Boris Johnson has been inclined to do. So we can get up another quote from him here. "I'm hopeful it will be the final lockdown so long as we are relatively cautious in coming out of this lockdown. If we relax too quickly without seeing the effect of each stage of relaxation, we may do what we've done before and relax too much, see a surge in case numbers, and still need to tighten up measures again." There were also some good nuggets of information in there. Neil Ferguson thinks 30% of the population have been infected, and warned that a full return to normality would be possible only once we see the real world effectiveness of COVID vaccines. So again, we're talking a lot of unknowns here that we need to get to grips with before we take any decisions that could be risky. So yeah, two different tones from the scientists, but saying quite similar things. However, the real danger is Boris Johnson's lockdown skeptic backbenchers aren't echoing the scientists. They're doing quite the opposite. He has listened to them in the past. Will he do it again? I'll be asking Dahlia that in a moment. But first of all, let's look at one of them. This is the main lockdown skeptic on Tory backbenches. He's called Mark Harper. He chairs the Tory COVID recovery group. And here he is this week speaking to Julia Hartley Brewer.
I've set out what I think is a sensible approach, which is reducing those restrictions in line with the rollout of the vaccine. So I've made the argument that once you've done the top four vulnerable groups, which we will be done in the next few days, you've got to allow 2 or 3 weeks for the vaccination effect to kick in. So we've said you need to start relaxing restrictions from March the 8th. And I've said, my own view is, and I think this is supported by many colleagues, that once you've vaccinated the top nine groups, that's the groups that account for 99% of deaths, 80% of hospitalizations. And it's not just, to be clear, not just people over 50. It also includes everyone between 16 and 64 who has a health condition that makes them vulnerable to COVID. So it includes them as well. Once you've vaccinated those groups, I think the argument for tough legal restrictions continuing simply that case isn't made.
Surely after the age of...
My colleagues will agree with me.
I mean, again, we don't need to cut COVID cases in hospital by 80% for the NHS not to be overwhelmed. They've managed to survive even at the peak in January. There's no reason, given the seasonality of this virus and with the rollout of the vaccine, to think we'd ever get close to anything like that again. In which case, I'm probably got hostage to fortune by saying that, but certainly in terms of, you know, the vaccine and from what the efficacy we've seen so far in places like Israel and in the UK, that would be extraordinarily unlikely, despite some of the more doom-mongery predictions from some doing that computer modelling, which previously, by the way, has always been proven to be way, way, way incorrect. But fundamentally, is there an excuse for any restriction on people's freedom at all, including things like mask wearing and the like, once the vast majority of people are protected from serious illness or death from this disease?
Well, no, my view is once you've done those top nine groups, I don't think there's any case for any legal restrictions. You know, people might still there might still be advice that people are asked to follow. But the point is that will be advice and it'll be then entirely up to people whether they follow it. I think the legal restrictions on people should end once those top nine groups are vaccinated.
So many things one could say about that clip. I mean, the thing that really stands out for me is people in this incredibly privileged position saying all legal restrictions can go. Once the most vulnerable people have been vaccinated, then it should be people's choice whether or not they put themselves in harm's way. Or, you know, once all the most vulnerable people have been offered the vaccine, he says on a separate podcast that if people don't take it up, that's, you know, their own problem. The problem there is that most people don't get to choose what risks they take. So if after we have vaccinated the most vulnerable, we say all legal restrictions go, then who's going to be asking their workers to come back and work in busy bars? Who's going to be asking their workers to come back and work in busy shops? It's going to be employers and workers are going to have to go there whether or not they want to take that risk. We know that long COVID is a serious risk. We know that some people of different ages do have severe reactions. Now, this isn't to say let's lock down everything until 100% of the population is vaccinated, but it is to say if you remove all legal restrictions, you are just leaving people so vulnerable to whatever their employer demands of them. And it's dangerous. I mean, also, you know, add to that, obviously, the reasons that John Edmonds was saying that even if you vaccinate 90% of the most vulnerable, that still leaves 10% of them unprotected. As to what Julia Hartley Brewer said, she said hospitals managed in January. Now, hospitals treated 100,000 COVID patients in January. NHS staff have PTSD. Over 30,000 people died that month, in a month. And Julia says it was fine. Have some respect. Have some respect, please. Dahlia, I want to go to you briefly. Is Boris Johnson going to follow the science this time? Or again, will he be sidetracked by the nutcases in his party and, you know, who have loud voices throughout the Murdoch press?
Yeah, I mean, we are in such a devastating situation when epidemiologists are having to elbow their way in to get the Prime Minister's attention in the middle of a pandemic and strategize on how to convince him to take their advice rather than that of Julia Hartley Brewer. That is absolutely devastating. And I think that the responsibility really does lie with him. And what I worry about is that we're going to see the same tactic of overpromising of, and again, we see this in this promising of back to normal, but we've been told time and time again that back to normal is not going to be feasible in the foreseeable future. What we need to be focusing on is a pathway to adjustment. So a pathway of understanding how we're going to actually live with this virus without it having the devastating effects that it has already had. And that involves having a functional test and trace system. It involves fully knowing the real world impact of having a 3-month gap for the Pfizer vaccine, which we don't really know what the outcome of that is. And we have to also remember that the majority of people who got the Pfizer vaccine are people who work in health and social care and the over 80s. So they're very vulnerable and they're very exposed. So this kind of over-promising and sort of dangling of the potential of, you know, everything being of us going completely back to how things were in 2019, that is the sign that is really telling me that this is going to go the same way as it has gone. And instead, what I really want to see is a commitment not to, oh, will we be able to go on holiday in summer and will we be back to normal by summer? But the rhetoric should really be, how are we going to use the summer to establish the infrastructures that will enable us to adjust to the new normal so that we're able to live with coronavirus without having to constantly go back into these incredibly restrictive, incredibly exhausting lockdowns. And so that responsibility really lies with Boris Johnson, and that is Boris Johnson's strategy. And obviously it's not helped by people like Julia Hartley Brewer, but Boris Johnson is the prime minister. And the fact that we're in this position with epidemiologists fighting with shock jocks to get, you know, their ideas into the public health strategy is a failure of the government.
You know, there's a danger. Some people say, oh, the left, you're just obsessed with lockdowns. You want them all the time. Now, for me, there are some really serious issues which urgently need to be addressed in this lockdown right now. So at the moment, kids still aren't allowed to play with kids from other households outside, right? That's one of the safest things you can do. You know, you're outside. This is an airborne disease. It's very unlikely you're going to pass COVID to each other. Kids need to socialize with each other. But in a situation where that's still banned, we're discussing whether or not we should be booking holidays in August. I mean, it's so warped. And it is because the media are only interested in this sort of like, yes, no, gotcha question about August. Can we go on holiday in August? This minister said yes. This minister said no. I mean, the reason they can't say is because none of us know. So why is there not at these press briefings, well, they're not every day now, but whenever they deign to speak to us from Downing Street, it should be the press saying, this rule, is this rule necessary? Should this support be given? But no, it's always just the next, when's it going to end? When are we going to be able to go on holiday? You know, there's so much to deal with in the here and now that it seems odd to me. Anyway, Labour have had another difficult week. Now, according to Survation, the party are down 5 points on the previous month at 33% in the polls. That's 6 points behind the Conservatives. However, it's on internal party matters that developments have been most dramatic. This week, we received the news that the release of a report by the Ford Inquiry has been suspended indefinitely. Now, the Ford Inquiry, most of our viewers will know about this because you're all Labour Party geeks. It was tasked with looking into the Labour leaks, and it had been due to report in July 2020. That date was then put off until early 2021. So right now, but a letter suspending it indefinitely was sent by Martin Ford QC, who's in charge of the inquiry, on Thursday. Now, in the letter to David Evans, who's the party's general secretary, Ford explained the reason for the delay was that the Information Commissioner's Office, a statutory body, and so that's a state body, is also looking into the leaks. And for that reason, he's decided, well, we can't do our report then. He explains in the letter, we have considered whether any aspect of our report can be disclosed despite the existence of the ICO's inquiries. However, after careful consideration, we consider there is a real risk that even partial disclosure of our report and findings could have the potential to prejudice the ICO's work. As soon as its inquiries are completed and resolved, we will provide a report. Now, it's unclear to me what they mean by prejudice, because the ICO is, you know, it's an independent organization. If they're investigating how different things were leaked, I don't think they're going to say, oh, we've read this Labour report now, which means that we can't be independent. It's not like a jury. You know, you prejudice a jury if the jury have read some really biased media reporting on that morning. That sometimes messes up trials. The Information Commissioner's Office, I don't think they can say, we can't make a judgment because there's already been a Labour report on this. It doesn't make sense to me. Given the allegations of racism against some of those named in the report, lots of other people aren't convinced. So this delay has sparked opposition from some of Labour's black MPs. Now, Damian Gale from The Guardian reported on this today. So he tweets, breaking, 9 black Labour MPs are writing to Keir Starmer to warn that the delay to the Ford inquiry risks further doubling down on the impression that the party is not taking anti-black racism seriously. Diane Abbott, Dawn Butler, Marsha de Cordova, Florence Eshelomi, Kim Johnson, Clive Lewis, Chion Wora, Kate Osamor and Bel Ribeiro Addy signed the statement. Significantly, some of those are in the shadow cabinet. He goes on, it says the possibility of a racist culture and a hostile environment for black members within the party needs to be addressed as a matter of urgency. And the Ford inquiry is an important tool for doing that. And it goes on that the abuse contained within the leaked report and the issues it seeks to address are incredibly serious. The fact that members who contributed to anti-black racism have been readmitted to the party is a cause of concern. And this delay only adds to the
anxiety. Now, to speak about this development, and we have a few more for you. Don't worry if you thought we hadn't yet mentioned the particular beef in the Labour Party that's been, you know, annoying you the most over the last 24 hours. We're going to go through them all. But Howard Beckett is joining us. He is Assistant General Secretary at Unite, one of the most high-profile left members of the NEC, and we are absolutely delighted to have you on. And also, I should say, sorry, we made you wait a little bit because this show is, there's just so much to talk about this evening.
No, Michael, it's good to see you. And I'm jealous of your haircut, Michael. I've got COVID hair and yours. I'm going to have to get clippers like yours.
It's quite easy. I did it this morning. Doesn't take long. I do recommend it. I can recommend you a set of clippers after the show, if you like. But the Ford report being put off for, well, indefinitely, I think. What's your take on this?
Well, my personal take is that it's completely inexcusable. And really, the letter that you've just read out from Michael Ford to David Evans makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The ICO being interested in allegations of sexism and racism is a new one on me. As far as I understood the ICO, their remit is considered with data breaches and data alone. And everybody who's listening understands that Ford was instructed to deal with three aspects relating to the leaked report. The first is the contents of that report, the sexist and racist commentary. Is it accurate? The second was how the report came into being and how did it come to be leaked. And the third is the culture that exists in Southside and the relationship between Southside and Lotto. Now, in respect of number one, sexism and racism, and in respect of number three, the relationship with Southside to Lotto and the culture within Southside, the ICO has no interest in that whatsoever. And it is a nonsense to say otherwise.
So for our audience, Southside, that's Labour Party HQ, where the staffers work. Lotto, leader of the opposition's office, where the politicians work. And obviously, they were at loggerheads in 2017, as you'll know if you watched our coverage of those Labour leaks. Let's talk about those allegations of racism. And there were some really strong words in that letter, which I say includes signatories in the shadow cabinet. So it's not just people who are opponents of Keir Starmer. They say this decision about the Ford inquiry risks further doubling down on the impression that the party is not taking anti-black racism seriously. Now, from what you've said already, it seems like that's something you agree with. And what were you talking about with the NEC meeting yesterday? Was there specific sort of examples of this from the National Executive Committee meeting?
Well,
that happened
the yesterday? Labour Party is walking, Michael, towards a reputation that is one that will sully the idea that it is an anti-racist party. It is walking towards that on a number of footings right now. And the NEC, and I have written today to the General Secretary of the Labour Party to reference this, the NEC has to be much more than simply words. It has to be deeds. Now, the issue that arose in yesterday's NEC was in reference to Sandwell, which is obviously a CLP that we've had a number of difficulties with. I would be sympathetic towards that. But two members of the NEC, two black members of the NEC, two Bay members of the NEC had been assisting in respect of the difficulties in Sandwell, and they were ruled ineligible for the panel as a consequence of it. Ruled ineligible, obviously, by a white chair on reference by another member of the NEC panel who was also white, referencing that they should be ineligible. No reason was given for it. No conflict of interest was talked about.
Because I'm not totally on top of this. Ineligible for what?
A future selection panel around Sandwell, right, Michael. So if two NEC members would go forward. Sandwell, obviously, a very diverse community. It's the responsibility of the NEC to reflect that whenever we put our members forward for such panels. Two white males were put forward. As a consequence of that, the left responded by putting Yasmin Dar forward, and she was voted down by the NEC. So what you effectively had is a situation for Sandwell selections where two BAME members of the NEC were ruled ineligible, and one BAME member of the NEC was voted down in respect of panel status in exchange for two white males, and the commentary mainly came from white members of the NEC. And that is simply not good enough, because the Labour Party has to act in respect of it. And at the same time, we were having a discussion around the community organisers who have disgracefully been given notice by the Labour Party, all of whom are Unite members, that their fixed-term contracts will come to an end at the end of May. Five of those 12 individuals are from the BAME community. That's a proportionality that simply does not exist anywhere else amongst Labour staff, and a proportionality that we should be proud of. And instead, they are getting their contracts terminated. And I personally have no doubt that the reason for that is a political reason, because they were appointments under the previous leadership. So we have Southside, our Labour headquarters, flying in the face of the commentary that we make about employment rights, rights from day one, put jobs first, terminating fixed term contracts, and five of the 12 are BAME members. And on top of that, Michael, on top of that, the most senior Muslim member of staff in the Labour Party is presently suspended. An individual who's never so much as had a face-to-face conversation with the General Secretary, and an individual who on three occasions offers his services to Keir Starmer whenever Keir Starmer came to his region and it was rejected. This is simply not good enough. The Labour Party has to be responsible for an anti-racist agenda, and it has to be judged by its acts, not its words.
One more controversy that's happened in the last 24 hours. What sounds like an incredibly chaotic, bizarre almost, annual general meeting of the Bristol West CLP. Now, Bristol West is one of the country's biggest CLPs. I've visited a number of times, very dynamic bunch of people. Recently, a lot of secretaries and chairs were suspended in that whole area, and especially in Bristol West, because they allowed debates about Corbyn's suspension to go ahead, or at least related to Corbyn's suspension. And in their place, sort of party bosses or regional party bosses have taken charge, and they held a CLP AGM yesterday. So to elect a new exec to replace the old one, even though the professionals had taken charge, it didn't sound like it was particularly professional. So there were 550 people attending. So it was a big deal. This is quite a big example of democracy in action, although it wasn't very democratic. I'm going to read, this is a report back from Matt Hollinshead, who is a member of Bristol West CLP. I know the guy, very trustworthy, believe what he's saying here, and I've heard it from multiple sources as well. So of the meeting, he writes, "The meeting was broadcast and chaired by regional office despite a valid sitting committee able to do so was in place. Candidates could not speak. Members could not speak. Questions asked of the chair, including points of order, were visible only to the unelected chair. The meeting took 6 hours. A candidate for secretary was disqualified for arrears despite the rulebook clearly stating they were eligible. Final counted ballots were not distributed until 5 hours after the start of registration for the meeting." So that's the biggest one. They signed in at 5:30. They didn't get their ballots until 5 hours later for no apparent reason. By that time, more than 100 of the 543 people in the meeting and eligible to vote did not vote, likely because they gave up on getting a ballot. Waiting 5 hours for a ballot is quite a while. Some people also got two ballots, some people got different ballots, and some ballots had both candidates against a single tick box. I understand that even where the ballot had two candidates that you could tick, they decided which one won. I mean, it seems like the Labour Party establishment aren't even pretending to believe in democracy at the moment. They are quite willing to go into a local party, even if it's huge, even if there are 550 people taking part, and just stomp all over due process.
They do want to stomp all over due process. But yes, it's a mess in Bristol. And what everybody should understand is that's the AGM taken over by the regional office in Bristol. The regional office has plenty of questions to answer in respect of their conduct in regard to suspending of members. Suspension seems to be the go-to approach of the Labour Party right now. No due process. People not even being told what rules they're alleged to have broken. Freedom of speech being curtailed and locked down, and regional offices stepping in order to run AGMs, stepping in, giving new Zoom details out, then taking ownership of the membership data. This isn't just in Bristol, which is an absolute shocking horror show tonight and a disgrace. Anybody who is responsible for that, ballots with voting boxes with two names next to them, 100 votes missed, like, people should be dismissed for pure incompetency before you come to the motivation behind it. But it's also in Streatham in London. So obviously Streatham in London, where Chukka was replaced by Bell and didn't even pass a motion of solidarity in respect of Jeremy Corbyn. And they received notice from their regional office that their AGM was to be held by the region, not by the CLP itself. All of their data stripped off of them. This is just not democracy whatsoever. You do not expect this in a Labour Party. You do not expect this in a Western country. And the Labour Party, frankly, needs to get a grip of itself, because otherwise they will be inundated with legal cases, many of which will be supported by My Union Unite, for freedom of speech and the curtailing of open democracy.
I want to go to an interview with Carolyn Harris, who's Keir Starmer's parliamentary private secretary, because, as I said, you're one of the leading voices on the left in the party, who's, you know, often quite oppositional to Keir Starmer. It seems now Starmer's people are fighting back. So Carolyn Harris, who is an MP and also, Keir Starmer's aide in Parliament, told the Huffington Post that Starmer's left-wing critics should bring it on. This is her sort of a punchy response to the criticisms of Keir Starmer. And in that interview, we've got some quotes from her. So she said, "All this nonsense about so-and-so and so is going to challenge him for the leadership. Bring it on, because it's nonsense. They are just making themselves look silly, talking on Zoom. That's all they're doing, talking to each other on Zoom. Come into the real world, my loves, and let's talk about the damage that's been done and the repair work that we're doing." Now, she goes on, "When I see these articles which say so-and-so and so-and-so is going to be challenging Keir for leader, and we need a left-wing candidate, that's the time I think, God, we're getting it right. We must be doing it right, because this is what it's all about. You've got to move on, haven't you? We had that project. It failed abysmally, and we're a laughing stock. Let's make no bones about it." On policy, she goes on, "And we lost them because we were selling a vision that nobody wanted to buy. Keir had to come in, get rid of all that nonsense, and start putting together a credible opposition and come forward with credible policy when we are in a strong place to deliver on it." Howard, when I read that, I was thinking, who's she talking about? I think, you know, a large part would be the sort of noises that Richard Bergen's been making this week. Someone else would probably be you. So how do you respond to Carolyn Harris saying, bring it on, and also come into the real world?
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Caroline Harris and others need to wake up to the fact that it is only the left of the party that has offered policies in the last 10 years. It is only the left of the party that has answers that the wider public need to hear. And it's the reason why in 2017, we touched the door of 10 Downing Street. But of course, we didn't get into the door of 10 Downing Street. And part of the reason for that is that people in Southside were working against us being in Downing Street in 2017. That's a key aspect of the Ford inquiry and what the Ford report must report on. It's the reason why I get so angry about it, Michael, because Unite put forward over £4 million to support the Labour Party in that election, and we deserve the answers. But moving forward to 2019, nobody should be in any doubt that that election was premised on one issue and one issue only. It was get Brexit done. It was the Brexit election, according to Sky News. So Caroline needs to wake up to the reality that this is about policy. If Keir Starmer wants to be successful as the leader of the Labour Party, then he will embrace left policies. But every step that we have seen since his leadership is one that has moved further and further towards the right of the party. And the present position that we're in, with the divisions and the conflicts, are not of the making of the left. It's not of the making of the trade unions. It's not of the making of those who would call themselves Corbynistas. These are divisions that are of the making of Keir Starmer and the people who surround Keir Starmer. And perhaps Caroline has given the game away in respect of her correspondence with Huffington Post, given the game away that actually this is what the agenda of the right wing was about, to cause conflict with the left, to ostracize the left, to make the left feel that the Labour Party is no longer their place of home. Well, here's a message for Caroline. Mimicking the Tories, becoming Tory-lite, pushing yourself out there as a patriot, and abandoning left-wing policies and failing to talk for the communities who need a Labour Party isn't helping you at the moment. The polls are going down because you're making the same mistakes that the right wing of the Labour Party has always made. And that is that you go around in silence with deaf ears, failing to listen to the communities that we must offer the policies that they can believe will change their lives. Caroline, you're Westminster heavy. Get out there and listen to what people need, and listen to what is needed from the trade unions to make the Labour Party successful, and change your narrative.
So in terms of your vision of what the Labour Party should be doing, Howard, I think your vision aligns with Navarra Media's quite a lot. So I'm not going to pretend to challenge you on that. What I do want to know, and where I suppose I have more doubts, is what can the left do about this? I mean, it does feel a bit like the left doesn't have that much institutional power to challenge what's going on. The right have a majority on the NEC. There aren't that many left-wing MPs in the PLP. And then a personal question, you know, one of the institutions that the left does have, thankfully, one of the legacies of Corbynism, although it actually preceded that, I suppose, is Unite has left leadership. And some people are worried that there's going to be more than one candidate going forward for the General Secretary of Unite. Can you reassure us that there's not going to be a split vote, which means that the right get in?
Well, listen, I'll come on to the Unite leadership in a second. I won't duck that question, obviously, Michael. But what can we do as a society? Listen, the trade union movement was founded on the principle of the trade unions. It was the trade unions that put the Labour Party together, and they put the Labour Party together because the debate was had that we needed a voice within the political arenas as well as industrial strength. And that has not gone away. It is the trade unions who will remain the bedrock of the Labour Party. And people come and go, leaders come and go. They're custodians for a movement that goes in the direction of workers' rights, and that is not going to be lost. And what can we do? Well, as a movement, as soon as we are through COVID, we must re-engage with community organising. The idea that Labour is finishing the contracts of community organising, some of us believe that that is the bedrock of socialism, that you must be organising in the communities, listening to those communities, in order for you to be an effective socialist party. And we need a socialist party in mainstream politics. So what will happen here is that the left will get active, the left will get into the communities, the left will show the ideas for change, the left will be the voice for working people. And people such as Caroline will find themselves marginalised, and that will either be marginalised in a Labour movement, or it will be alternatively marginalised within Westminster. Because the wake-up call for those, and especially whenever you've seen this repeated use of the Union Jack, the wake-up call for everybody should be that politics is moving away from Westminster. People are starting to understand that to affect their own lives, they want their politics in their own regions, in their own nations, and politics in their workplace. That's what community organising is all about, finding those champions who believe that they can go out there and be the voice for socialism. And the trade union movement will not move away from that. No amount of suspensions, no amount of narrative from the likes of Caroline Harris, no amount of problems that you might have with current leadership will move the trade union movement away from the fact that our bedrock is working class people in the communities and representing their voice in the political arenas. And I say arenas for a good reason. There is much more than Westminster politics, and the trade union movement is going in that direction, even if the current leadership of the Labour Party is some way behind. Moving on to the Unite leadership, I hate to be the harbinger of doom for all of those centrics and right-wingers out there who are sitting waiting for Unite to fall into the hands of a right-wing leadership such as a well-known ex-regional secretary of the West Midlands. It is not going to happen. Unite will remain in the hands of the left. It will be a left leader that will take Unite forward. There's a very good reason for that, and that is that we have a limit in respect of the amount of branches that are needed in order for you to get on the ballot paper. I do not believe the Unite branches will want to put a right-wing candidate on the ballot paper. But obviously, if that happened, if I was wrong, and I'd be knocked over by a feather if I was wrong, to be frank, because I know the Unite membership, I know the activists, and I know that they want Unite premised on the left of society. But if I was wrong for some reason, then those who are described as left-wing candidates would have to come together and reach an accommodation, because what cannot happen at any stage in the next cycle of trade union leadership is that Unite, the foremost left union in the countries, cannot fall into the hands of the right wing. That would be a disaster. It's not something that I would be prepared to see happen. And it's not something that the Unite membership and the wider movement would ever excuse us for. So a harbinger of doom for those of the centric world, the left will be running Unite for some years to come.
So the clarification there, if a right winger gets on the ballot, the left will only put forward one candidate. Is that's
yeah,
correct?
The right wing will not get on the ballot, Michael. You're hearing it from me first, because it is a high bar that they would have to meet, and our branches will not allow that to happen. But if for any reason I was wrong, you can do two things. First of all, knock me over with that feather that I've referenced. And secondly, put the lock on the door until the three candidates who describe themselves at the left reach an agreement as to who the candidate should be.
Good to know. I think that will reassure many of our audience. Howard Beckett, thank you so much for joining us this evening. A real pleasure, as always.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Regular viewers of this show will know there are few journalists in Britain who spout more irresponsible nonsense than Talk Radio's Julia Hartley Brewer. Whether it be demonising migrants or railing against lockdowns, the Murdoch-employed shock jock is a pernicious presence on our airwaves. And this week, she kept her winning streak of chronic misinformation going. Here she is interviewing the discredited US journalist Andy Ngoh.
There does seem to be one rule for one and one rule for the other. Now, the argument on the day of that Washington DC saw those protests and that storming of the Capitol, the argument being that if they had been, say, Black Lives Matter protesters, they would have been treated very differently by law enforcement, because if they'd been black, not white. And yet we have actually seen very different law enforcement, very different media coverage when we see particularly Antifa, but also Black Lives Matter protests, almost sort of saying, well, these people feel passionately. It's somehow it's justifiable. It's understandable. But I imagine when it's your business or your home that's been burnt down, or you're living in fear every night, that the people, you know, coming into your neighborhood to do that it doesn't really matter what the cause is. There's still the same level of fear.
Yeah, the arguments that if the protesters or rioters have been left-wing or far left, and they would have been treated much harsher, that's absolutely not true. You can look, for example, how they were treated, let's say, in Seattle, the largest city in the Pacific Northwest, when BLM and Antifa actually claimed territory as a separate sovereign city-state, CHAZ, for more than 3 weeks. The federal response from that and the state response was essentially to let them go and do it. And this area, the no-go zone, which they set up a hard border that was manned by armed militias, devolved into chaos and multiple homicides and shootings.
Now, he was saying that, you know, the idea, if the left had gone into Capitol Hill, they would have been treating worse. That's ridiculous. The left wouldn't have got into the Capitol building. I mean, it's just unimaginable that they would have managed to get in there. We know that the police seem to be going light, potentially because of orders from above. So the idea, and especially it might not even be so much left-right as a black-white thing. I mean, the cops in America treat people differently based on their race. This is not particularly controversial, although I'm sure it is to Andy Ngoh. At the beginning of that clip, because I don't want to focus too much on what he said, I want to focus on who this guy is. What is his status as a journalist? And I said he was a discredited US journalist. Now, why did I say that? Now, Andy Ngoh isn't as famous in this country as he is in the United States. But across the pond, he's made his name by hanging out with far-right demonstrators and filming aggression from people on the left. So he's always posting on Twitter, look at these Antifa, they're the real thugs, they're the real violent ones. Now, he's often dismissed by leftists as a tool of the far right. He always has been. But on the likes of Fox News, where he frequently appeared, he was able to put himself forward as an independent and objective journalist, someone who just takes a camera to protests. However, and this is why I say discredited, because it all began to fall apart. In September 2019, a left-wing activist went undercover with the far-right Proud Boys group. Rolling Stone have a good write-up of the downfall of Andy Ngoh. So how a right-wing troll managed to manipulate the mainstream media. So this is from a while ago, and this is them sort of outing him as the activist he is. Let's go to that article. So they say, last week, the local newspaper, the Portland Mercury, reported that a left-wing activist going undercover as a member of Patriot Prayer, a far-right group known for promoting and engaging in violent clashes with leftist activists, had given the publication an 18-minute video that included footage of Ngoh with a group of Patriot Prayer members as the members discuss an upcoming brawl, including weaponry to be used in altercations with Antifa. Ngoh, who describes himself as a journalist, did not record the conversation and does not appear to have his camera or notebook out. For part of the footage, he is seen on his phone. So this is someone who is there. They're not really there to report on the far right, because what they tend to do is just take pictures of the left looking aggressive, who is there with a far right group when they're planning what sounds like quite illegal stuff. And he doesn't seem to think this is interesting enough to take notes for. The article goes on. The source told the Mercury that Ngoh and Patriot Prayer have an understanding that the group offers him protection when he covers rallies in exchange for favorable coverage. While this has not been confirmed and Ngoh strongly denies these allegations, an audio conversation between members of the Proud Boys released by Willamette Week seems to confirm that such discussions between Ngoh and the Proud Boys had occurred, as one man is recorded saying that Ngoh was attacked on June the 29th because he refused an offer of protection. Andy Ngoh was fucking told that if he wanted protection from the Proud Boys, he went in with us and he went out with us, the man says. So this all presents him as not a neutral journalist, someone who is basically almost participating, really, as someone who is on these far-right protests and is propagandizing on their behalf. That's what it seems like. It's a huge far-right talking point to say the real aggressive people are Antifa. You know, the real fascists are Antifa. We're just patriots. That's the argument you'll hear from the far-right, which is one that the work of Andiengo sort of strengthens. And it seems that that's what it's intended to do. Now, you might say, look, this is, you know, he's an activist. Navarra Media, they're also activists. To some extent, that's true. We, though, don't make up conspiracy theories. No, we don't make up conspiracy theories. Andiengo has. This is from that same Rolling Stone article. You can go read the whole thing. I do recommend it. Now, this says, in the hours following the mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, which took more than 20 people's lives, Engo was instrumental in promoting the conspiracy theory that Antifa had played a role. When that was thoroughly debunked, he helped perpetuate the theory that the man behind the Dayton, Ohio shooting was a member of Antifa, despite the fact there is no evidence he was involved in local activism or organizing. So this is someone who's saying these mass murders are the fault of Antifa. And we all really know what that's about. You know, when you say this group are murderers, you're kind of, you know, if you're the favored journalist of the far right, then that's sort of sending a message, which is violence is somewhat okay. So you might think, you know, Julia Hartley Brewer probably shouldn't get this guy on the show. He's posing as a journalist and an author. Actually, he's an activist, and an activist with some fairly unsavory groups who talk radio wouldn't like to explicitly be giving a platform to. You might think that even if she did get him on, at least she should challenge him somewhat. You know, she's asking him about an issue which is very relevant to this. She's asking him about Antifa and how right-wing protests go, how left-wing protests go, and she doesn't really challenge him on the fact that maybe he's a bit more of a participant than a journalist here, and that, you know, lots of stuff he's reported in the past wasn't true. This was picked up by my esteemed colleague Ash Sarkar. She tweeted a bunch of the points I've just shown you to Julia Hartley Brewer and asked, "Hey Julia, is this the same Andiengo who circulated utterly discredited conspiracy theories after a far-right terrorist attack in El Paso, who is said to have had protection arrangement with a white supremacist organization and was party to their plans to cause violence?" Very good question. Julia Hartley Brewer responds, "I've no idea. I'm not responsible for what my guests do." Now, in response to this, Ash points out the obvious. "What do you mean you have no idea? He came to talk about his book, which is about Antifa, and he has a history of pushing discredited conspiracy theories about Antifa. Shouldn't a journalist know about that before interviewing him so you could challenge him on it?" Julia Hartley Brewer, because she takes journalism so seriously, her responsibilities as a national broadcaster so seriously, she said, "Yawn. You think everyone who doesn't share your views is a neo-Nazi collaborator, Ash. It's boring now." Now, clearly, Julia Hartley Brewer hadn't read that article, because the article suggests that, yes, there is actually some evidence that he was collaborating with neo-Nazis. I mean, he was clearly fairly close to them. That's what the Proud Boys and the Prayer Boys are. Was it the Prayer Boys? I forget all of their different names. Anyway, we'll go with the Proud Boys for now. That's what they are. And we can assume that Julia Hartley Brewer hasn't bothered reading those. Julia Hartley Brewer, let's go to her final tweet. She says, "I think Mr. Andiengo has done some important work covering violent protests, and I invited him on my show to discuss his book about that work. If you want to ask him different questions, why don't you DM him? I'm just not interested in your tired agenda." You know, she's saying he did some important work. It's not my responsibility to ask about how he's done work in exactly that domain before, which has proved to be conspiratorial and fake. It's a bit like interviewing David Irving on the Second World War and saying, "Oh, the book was good. Why would I have asked him about the fact that he's been convicted as a Holocaust denier?" Well, what's relevant about that? Of course it's relevant, because the fact that someone spouts racist conspiracy theories in one part of their discipline means that you probably shouldn't believe what they say in the rest of it. I mean, especially if it's completely related, as it is in this particular instance. Actually, I said that was the final Julia Hartley Brewer tweet. I apologize. There's one more. Let's go to this. This is the final one. "Ash Sarkar and chums are jolly angry with me for interviewing Andiengo about his new book. Not asking him the right questions makes me a fascist or something. They'd be even more cross if you retweeted the interview. That would make you a fascist too. So don't do it," with a winking face. I suppose it is one thing to get caught out interviewing a charlatan without doing the background research. It's kind of another to double down and saying, why would I do the background research on someone I'm interviewing, even though their background story is directly relevant to what I'm interviewing them about.
Julie Hartley Brewer might not be responsible for everything that her guests do, but she is responsible for what she does when her guests are on her show. And she's also kind of responsible with who she brings on and why, you know, and for what purpose. And she brought this guy on to legitimize a framework that she's very heavily invested in, that she's really built a career off, which is, you know, to portray the left, to portray progressives, to portray Black people, brown people as some kind of inherent threat to people's safety, and therefore a force that needs to be like clamped down on, which kind of leads to all kinds of scary things. And this thing with the Proud Boys and sort of the way that they use journalism in this way, this is a tactic that kind of reminded me of something that was developed against Muslim communities in the UK, actually, which is when you read more about the kind of strategies that they would employ, they kind of resonate, which is, you know, far-right groups like Britain First would go into mosques or Muslim neighborhoods and basically start, you know, behaving in a really threatening and provocative manner. And then when they get a reaction, they start filming and then use that footage to spread fear and say, you know, look how sort of violent and threatening this group are. They need to be cracked down on by the police, by surveillance, by border police or whatever. And, you know, that's what you do when you don't have an argument. You sort of rely on good old sort of state power to do it for you. But, you know, and I might kind of end up proving to an extent one of Julie Hartley Brewer's her last tweet there, but in what I'm about to say. But we really need to be really careful here. And it's because it's easy to write someone off like Hartley Brewer as sort of just a fringe, sort of somewhat comical voice, but you know, she holds a lot of power. She's regularly invited on to BBC Question Time, to, you know, flagship BBC shows. She has her own show, a really big radio station. And this kind of like lurch to the far right in this way, and this entrance of far right thinking into the mainstream and into actual government policy, it often starts in this way. It starts as kind of fringe voices that people don't take very seriously. So they kind of keep their eye off the ball while they amass a huge amount of social and cultural power. And then we get caught off guard when suddenly the political spectrum has swung very, very far to the right. And it's swung so far that it's very difficult to then pull it back. And this kind of, you know, and I called her this before, this sort of shock jock conspiratorial sort of style of radio propaganda that has been popular for a very long time in the US, and I don't think it played an insignificant part in you know, the transformation of the Republican Party and the eventual election of Donald Trump. And we're seeing these same tactics being used in the UK and really ramped up of this particular brand of very well-resourced, financially backed right-wing media, and it seems particularly prevalent in the radio space. You know, Bolsonaro himself, to think of another person, as well as the example of Trump and sort of the shock jock media, Bolsonaro himself started off as a kind of fringe, you know, having a fringe sort of like media profile, having a segment on television that was sort of seen as a comical thing. And then it sort of is how he consolidated a huge amount of power. And that brings us to what many have portrayed as a kind of buffoonish attack on the Capitol. You know, we see kind of the pictures of people dressed up and all of this, and we kind of, part of it, it becomes very heavily memed, right? And it's sort of, we look at it as being a sort of chaotic thing that failed, and then it ended up in Donald Trump leaving office, and then, you know, that's kind of the lid on that. But it's easy to brush those moments off, but this is really the far right and groups like Proud Boys who are being connected to these kind of journalists that are portrayed as neutral journalists and are allowed to carry that clout for a long time. But this is really the far right calibrating itself. They're testing the waters, they're testing out different coalitions and different narratives and figuring out what it can get away with. That it's a sign of deep organization and deep embeddedness. And I want to remind people that these kinds of fascist insurrections, they always fail before they succeed. And the fact that they're getting signal boosted, you know, in that context of growing social and cultural capital, the fact that figures like Andy are being signal boosted in what we can say is mainstream radio in the UK is very worrying. it's an incremental stage in what is a longer, wider trend. And so we need to be very careful.
We should also add, it's not only Julia Hartley Brewer who has platformed this man, also the Wall Street Journal, which, as I should probably add, is also owned by Rupert Murdoch. This man has a lot to answer for, famously published an article by Andy Ngo saying that East London, so in Tower Hamlets, the area near East London Mosque had become like Riyadh. And because of pressure from Muslims, or it was implied that because of pressure from Muslims, it had become an alcohol restricted zone. Now, anyone who's ever been to Brick Lane knows that's not quite true. Apparently, there is one small grassy square in that area where drinking is not allowed. And the council have said that's because of an antisocial behaviour thing. It has nothing to do with Sharia law being implemented in East London. So this guy is a grifter. Dahlia, it's depressing, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is the sort of the state of the media landscape. And when you have that in the context of, you know, we had at the beginning of this interview, at the beginning of this show, the interview with Nathan, and sort of looking at the kind of irrelevance that the more kind of liberal, more progressive spaces in the mainstream media are kind of withering and becoming very, very toothless. It's a very, very worrying trend. And that's why organizations like Navara are so important. Just put up a little segue for you there, Michael.
You put the segue in there. Thank you, Dahlia. You know what to do. That is true. If you want a non-toothless media that can challenge these right-wing grifters and won't fire people for sending tweets about Israel, do go to navaramedia.com/support and donate the equivalent of 1 hour's wage a month. If you do that already, thank you so much. You make this possible. If not, you know what to do, because I've already said to do it. For now, Dahlia, it has been an absolute pleasure, as always.
Yeah, it's been lovely. Really good show today.
And thank you for watching. We'll be back on Monday at 7 p.m. You've been watching Tisky Sour on Navara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navara Media. Go to navaramedia.com/support.